This episode, Once Upon a What If. Hello, and welcome to the Once Upon a Geek podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. On today's episode, we are finding our joy by talking about the fantastic Marvel comic series that explores the multiverse of cause and effect, a comic series we all love entitled What If? Now, my name's the Irredeemable Shag, and I'm your host, but I'm not doing this alone. For this episode about What If, I knew I had to invite a true Marvel Comics fan. Now, you can tell my co-host today is a true Marvel zombie because he's a Punisher of vermin. In his household, he's known as The Collector, and he lives in upstate New York, which this time of year is practically makes him an Iceman. Folks, please help me welcome to the show, JT the Exterminator. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, how's it going, Shag? I would probably say I'm closer to the Iron Man villain Blizzard, considering we just got hit with a blizzard for Christmas this year.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, everything got postponed a few days while we all sat and got snowed in, and thankfully I didn't lose power or heat or anything, just got on the wife's nerves twice as much as usual.
It's already a big list there, buddy. So, wow, that's extra helpings.
Yes.
You and I had recorded a JLI podcast together, and we had a great time, and I knew I wanted to get you back for something. And then you were foolish enough to respond to one of my posts about What If, and I realized that's my guy. I knew I wanted to talk about What If with you. And I got to ask you, you know, so what is it that you love about the What If concept? You know, I'm talking big picture here. Now, we'll drill down to specifics later, but what do you love about the concept or the series of What If?
I kind of have two answers for that. And a big part of it is it's always nice seeing those alternate universe stories, whether it's DC Elseworlds or even just stuff that isn't branded a What If. But if you're familiar with a character and then seeing that character's either history or that character themselves, you know, flipped upside down and it's done the right way, it's just instantly intriguing. The other thing that I like about the What If idea, at least for me personally, and we'll get into this, it'll make me want to read the original version of events in order to kind of roundabout way get back to that What If. So as a result, one of the reasons why I have not read a ton of What If Volume 2 is exactly that reason. At that time, I had not read Evolutionary War, for example.
And okay.
I've been told I'm probably not missing much, but I didn't want to then read the What If events if things went a different way with the Evolutionary War until I read that. And I still haven't read all of Evolutionary War, but I want to. And then I feel like What If you get more out of it when you know what really took place, in my opinion.
So I actually will take a little bit of a different approach, similar to yours, as far as, you know, the reading the story and whether you know the original story or not. For me, I came at What If in a lot of ways not knowing anything about these stories. And I learned a lot of Marvel Comics history from reading What If. That's one of the reasons I love it. Like the official handbook of the Marvel Universe, like that encyclopedic format, for whatever reason, from Marvel, just didn't grab my imagination. Certainly it did with DC and Who's Who, but the Marvel version didn't for some reason.
Well, it's written like a textbook.
It absolutely is. You're right. And I suppose with What If, like the storytelling nature of What If was what really helped me get excited about this Marvel history that I was learning. You know, it always stuck with me. Like, I learned a lot of Marvel history from What If, and that was exciting. Kind of like I did from Marvel Saga. Same thing. Marvel Saga, I learned a lot of Marvel history as well.
Love Marvel Saga. I was just going to bring that up.
Fun series. Like you, I like to see the alternate takes because I'm a big time travel fiction fan. And the whole idea of how history happened differently has always been fascinating. And these things are so much fun because, like, a lot of times, you know, whatever the lead premise of the story is, you know, something happened differently or something happened horribly, whatever. And an entirely different series of new adventures are created within that issue. Like a new superhero team is formed, or one of your favorite heroes took a completely different direction in their lives or whatever. It sort of felt like being on the ground floor of an entirely new series, like an issue number one, every single issue of What If. And I always found that exciting. And the whole concept of one and dones for the most part with What If was great as well.
So the one and dones, I totally agree with you. I've always liked that, especially when I was a kid growing up. I didn't love multi-part stories, or I should say crossovers into multiple titles, because, you know, you're a kid, you only have so much money, you know, there's only so many lawns to mow. But what one of the things that I liked about those alternate history stories, you know, especially with What If. So technically, they're all canon of sorts, if, mm-hmm. if you really get hung up on stuff like that, because it's just telling a story from a different Earth or a different timeline. And the idea of potentially revisiting those or even getting sequels to those, I know didn't happen very often, but there are some stories that I think needed that. And maybe we never got them. And I'll get into that when we go down the line here of some of our discussion topics here. But that was always something that appealed to me. The other thing, too, actually, I forgot to mention was when we saw these alternate takes, especially on an event, you know, Peter Parker's marriage or like I said, Evolutionary War. It to me as a kid, and even now, it makes those moments seem more epic or legendary because we're already getting a story that's an alternate take. So it must be important if we're spending more time on it. You know, the creators are doing. So that was always, maybe that kind of played on a subconscious level, but kind of like the Marvel cards of the 90s. You know, you got those famous battles subset mm-hmm. in there, mm-hmm. and it was like, oh wow, Thing versus Hulk. That's a big deal. And of course, they've done it 40 times, but still, then for some reason, I see that happen, and it's like, this is a big deal because the card told me so.
Well, you're right. Because back then, you know, we didn't have reprints. We didn't have collected editions. We didn't have trade paperbacks or whatever. So the fact an older event was referenced, then it's like, oh, you're right. This is important. I should know more about it. So, yeah. All right. So we have a lot more to talk about What If. Before we do that, though, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of Once Upon a Geek is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for comic book trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off, with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode we'll select a comic collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStock Trades library. Usually it's tied into our discussion in some way, shape, or form. I picked today a little bit of an offbeat one, but I think you'll see why. I picked Star Trek Boldly Go Trade Paperback Volume 3. Now, we're here talking about Marvel. What am I doing talking about Star Trek? Well, this Star Trek trade paperback is a big, giant what if. Basically, they do all these parallel universes, like what if Kirk and the Enterprise crew were robots? What if the Klingons founded the Federation? What if Spock wasn't a Vulcan? They do all these alternate realities, and then they all collide in this mega event, which is IDIC is what they called it, which of course is Infinite Diversity and Infinite Combinations from the Vulcans. But it was this really cool series within a series. It took place in Star Trek Boldly Go 13 through 18, published by IDW. Now, if you've never read any of these Star Trek Boldly Go stories from IDW and you like Star Trek, I highly recommend it. It was a great series. I really enjoyed it. I was able to dip in and out depending on the storyline. Really like the Boldly Go story, and it also makes a really fun potty humor joke if you want to talk about it. Anyway, writer's Mike Johnson, artist is Josh Hood, cover art is by Tony Chastain. Page count, it's 144 pages, it's full color, it's a soft cover, normally retails for $19.99, but you can get it for 35% off right now, so it's only $12.99 on InStock Trades. Great opportunity for you to play in the What If universe for Star Trek. So JT, what'd you bring today?
All right, so I wanted a challenge here. I didn't want to just recommend a What If trade paperback. InStock Trades does have some available. In fact, the entirety of Volume 1 of What If, the series, is available via Omnibus, if that's your format. But what I wanted to do was find something in kind of how you chose Star Trek that's in the same vein. I kind of wanted to play with that idea. You know, I was looking for Old Man Logan, Hulk, Future Imperfect, Earth X.
Good
some
ideas.
Of these, I'm sure, you know, most people have read, and if not, I absolutely highly, highly recommend those. However, all three of those Marvel does not have in print. So, you know, they're not currently in stock. They're somewhat evergreen, or they were. So I imagine they're going to be back in a trade somewhere at some point. Yeah, I can't make that InStock Trades recommendation either. So what I'm going to do is highlight one of my all-time favorite Doctor Doom stories, easily in my top three. And even though the events of this do technically happen, it reads like a what if.
Okay.
Have you ever read Marvel graphic novel number 27, Emperor Doom?
You know, I have not.
Okay, so this is available in the Avengers Epic Collection Volume 17, Judgment Day, which for folks that might not know, the Marvel Epic Collections are kind of just nice, about 450-page soft cover tomes that just take chunks of continuity throughout all the, you know, 60s through kind of going into the 90s, into the early 2000s of just Marvel history. And, you know, this is obviously Avengers Volume 17, so it's right there at the tail end of Roger Stern's run towards the middle of the 80s. And they'll collect crossovers in reading order in these things. The Epic Collections are awesome for that. If you just want to read these stories, they're you know, one of my preferred methods of reading this stuff. Suggested retail price on this is $39.99. You get 38% off on in-stock trade. So you're looking at $24.79. It collects many other things in here, but I'm specifically talking about that Marvel graph novel, number 27, Emperor Doom, written by David Michelinie, drawn by Bob Hall. And it's basically, it could have been titled, What If Dr. Doom Finally Conquered the World?
Okay.
I'm not going to, of course, give you any spoilers on this, but this is pretty much Dr. Doom figures out a way to officially conquer the world in one of the most creative ways, utilizing Marvel history and Marvel characters. I guess I'll say it that way. And we basically have a small team of Avengers that have to put the world back the way it was. But they wonder if they should, because maybe things aren't so bad with how Dr. Doom's running the world.
Oh, wow.
It's good stuff. And I will also say this, because he probably never gets any love, is this is a Simon Williams spotlight also of a story.
I love Wonder Man.
Yes. And this is not Wonder Man in the leisure coat. This is the armless black Under Armour with the big red W, Wonder Man. So, you know, I think he looks a little less goofy than he unfortunately has a history of with his costume changes.
That's my favorite version of Wonder Man, by the way. Yep. And like his own ongoing series, the look he had there, I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that kind of spun from this look. But yeah, so this was during the time of East Coast Avengers and West Coast Avengers. And I can't recommend this story alone enough. But yeah, you can get it fairly cheap in a collection with other Avengers stories. So yeah, I highly, highly recommend this.
Well, I got to say, as I mentioned, I haven't read it. However, you've absolutely sold me. David Michelinie is a huge win, especially writing Dr. Doom. He's got a long history doing that anyway with the Iron Man stories where he's been doing Dr. Doom as well. And then I will also echo your love for the Epic Collections. I bought a few myself and they are phenomenally well put together. And it depends. Yep. Each one's a little bit different, but I bought some where they're pulling stuff from like an X-Men collection I bought is pulling stuff from crazy places. Like you're getting an issue of Marvel Team Up is thrown in there, an issue of Spider-Man's thrown in there, an issue of Hulk is thrown in there. Like, what is this doing? Oh, because Havoc's in there or Polaris is in there, you know, or whatever. And they really pull stuff in from weird oddball places. Some of them even include like text pieces talking about some of the changes and transitions. Epic Collections are really worth the investment. I love them.
Yeah, I'm staring at my bookshelves now. I mean, it's an ever-growing collection. They're always announcing new ones coming out. They're probably over 300 strong at this point, and there's no stopping them at this point. It's the stuff they put in there, it's well worth your time. Some of those volumes are out of print, so folks may run into, you know, unfortunately, some eBay high prices, but they tend to put these back into print on a fairly regular basis. So
awesome.
Highly recommended. Yeah, the Epic Collections are fantastic.
Well, folks, for these two collected editions and all your trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. Now, this episode is also sponsored in part with your Patreon support, because, you know, running the network, the Fire and Water Podcast Network, with so many shows, you know, it requires a lot of online hosting and other services and fees and things like that. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with some of the expenses. So we launched our Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help us keep the network going. So if you're enjoying our shows on our network, the best way to support us is by visiting our Patreon, which is patreon.com/FW Podcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the network, and in certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on your favorite shows. This episode, special thanks go out to David A. Gutierrez and Gord Tolton. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcast. Now, folks, this is the part where I need you to get involved. You are here as a representative of the geek community to talk about the things you love. If you downloaded this episode, clearly you'll love What If. So I want to hear from you. Sound off. Go on the social media. Go out on Twitter. Go on Facebook, whatever. More importantly, go on our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek, and share your thoughts. I want to hear what you think about What If. What do you love about the concept? You know, is there any favorite issues? Do you prefer volume one or volume two or what else? So again, the best way to be part of that conversation is in our comment section on the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com/onceuponageek. On Twitter, you can find it as Once Upon a Geek. On Facebook or Instagram, we're Once Upon a Geek Podcast. And just a reminder, I will be reading portions of your feedback that are posted to our website. I'll be reading those every fifth episode of Once Upon a Geek. So if you're not keeping track at home, and I'm happy to do that for you, this is the eighth episode of Once Upon a Geek. So you've still got time to get your feedback in on our website. All right, so JT, you and I, we're going to step aside for a minute. We're going to take a quick podcast promo break. And when we come back, we're going to ask ourselves, what if?
The swamp, more than merely a place. It is a churning, seething, bubbling bed of life of which you are a part. Once you were a man, a king. chemist named Ted Salas until one little experiment went somewhat awry. And you changed. The serum that was to have made you a super soldier combined with the strange forces in the swamp to make you over into this, a shambling, mindless mockery of your former humanity. The macabre Man-Thing. Man-Thing was created in the early 1970s to capitalize on the growing monster craze, but under writer Steve Gerber, it became something quite different. Experimental, surreal, and very, very weird. It was something I loved as a kid, but does it still hold up today, 4 decades after its initial publication? So join me, Paul Matthew Carr, as I attempt to make sense of this cult classic and analyze each issue, putting it in the context of the time it was written and comparing it to the standards of today. And maybe you too can come to love the world's second most famous swamp-based comic book character as much as I do. The Nexus of All Realities, a Man-Thing podcast, a twice-monthly dive into the bizarre.
Love him or hate him, everybody's got something to say about John Byrne.
He ruined the X-Men when he left.
That John Byrne, he's a sexist pig.
The only thing bigger than John Byrne's ego is... Oh, wait, there isn't anything bigger than John Byrne's ego.
John Byrne, oh, he just draws the greatest butt on Superman. It looks so good.
John Byrne is the greatest artist I've ever seen. Wait, who is he?
John Byrne's 1986 Man of Steel series gave us the core reimagining of Superman that is still with us today.
Third Degree Burn, a podcast about all things John Byrne. The good, the bad, and the legendary. Join Tim Elliott and Brian Hughes as they look over the nearly 5 decades body of work of one of the most influential comic book creators in the last 50 years. Third Degree Burn can be found at twotruefreaks.com and on iTunes.
I've got a question, though. I'm curious. Why doesn't Green Lantern have any junk?
All right, folks, we are back and we're going to talk about What If, but the way we're going to do it is we're going to talk a little bit big picture. And then for fun, what JT and I decided to do is we're each going to highlight one particular issue of What If to talk about. So that's how we're going to do. So JT, why don't you tell us about the origins of the What If comic and who had a hand in all this?
All right. So where I gleaned my information from on this one is directly from What If issue 1, which started the whole thing. This was back in February 1977 issue. At the very back, of course, like with every first issue, there's usually not letters yet for a letters page. So it's a text piece. And this is from Roy the Boy Thomas, who was, he was firing on all cylinders in those early 70s, just coming up with new, interesting concept. The House of Ideas was still that very much in that time period. And I think a lot of them came from Roy as far as, you know, kind of that big picture, you know, series concept type stuff. And this was one of them. And, you know, I'll just kind of paraphrase some of what he says here in the it's like a 2-page text piece titled Why Not? And he basically mentions a couple things. He was one of the first people to really start working directly with and under Stan Lee in those late 60s. Picking up the reins, writing stuff that Stan was no longer writing, but he worked with Stan a lot with plotting and what have you. And one of the things he said Stan would do a lot was remark, "What if?" And that would sometimes get the ball rolling on a plot that Stan would kind of fumble around with and try and figure out. Apparently, Stan always really paid close attention to his fan mail. I should say Marvel's fan mail. You know, you had people writing in, you know, "Oh, who's tougher? You know, Thor or Hulk?" Things like that. And, you know, what if the Fantastic Four went bankrupt, which he actually put in a story. I think that was FF number 10 I believe.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
I think so. And I think that was one where Submariner had his own movie studio. We won't talk about that right now. but yeah, so that was always something that kind of, at least according to this article, Roy kind of kept in the back of his head, you know, that just that question, what if? And he was working on coming up with, we want to do a double-sized comic format, 50 cents, which is what these old what ifs were. The original volume were thick. You know, they were thicker, about double the size of a regular comic. And he wanted it to showcase something kind of, you know, epic, kind of something that is going to take those five dimes from the kids back then. So he started playing around with what stories could we tell that we couldn't tell in our regular continuity. He said that there were some ideas of like Counter Earth, and there was one where I think Reed Richards had become the Brute, so on a different alternate world. But these were all in the regular books that he was kind of telling the folks that were working on these comics to kind of rein that back a little bit. You know, he doesn't want to get too bogged down, you know, with all of that alternate character and history and stuff. He didn't want to make the books confusing. Imagine that. And he kind of made this the showcase for it. And he felt that he would call it What If? And he knew that Stan Lee would love the title. So that wasn't a problem, he said, there. But he said he thought this would be where all of our parallel world stories would be told. Now, it didn't always stay that way. And, you know, a lot of times folks and creative teams still worked in their parallel world stories elsewhere, like Days of Future Past, for example, that didn't take place in a What If. But he also had the idea to have all of these narrated by Uatu the Watcher, because he specifically wanted to make sure that, yeah, we're having some fun and coming up with these stories of alternate takes, but I still want them to matter. And he goes, you know, they all do take place, just not in, quote, our world. And I mm-hmm. think I thought that was one of the genius aspects to the whole concept, quite honestly, is it's all out there and it all counts, again, if that's something that you really pay attention to.
And it's interesting how many ideas have started as a what if, and mm-hmm. if either directly spun out, like Spider-Girl,
sure,
which is a big thing that spun out of what if, or sort of subtly, like, you know, Gwen Stacy not dying. I mean, that kind of became a big thing, or the Avengers of the 50s, which become the
Agents of Atlas.
Agents of Atlas. I mean, so yep. many of these things have gone on to become an ongoing story within Marvel. Sure. So yeah, they can't help but spark from the ideas.
Yeah, the big one, Jane Foster getting Thor's hammer. That comic itself became a key issue in the back issue market because of what they then later did with Mighty Thor and all that.
You're absolutely right. I'm actually, as we were chatting, I was flipping through my What If Classic trade paperback, yes. Volume 2, that's got that story in there, and it's got the Agents of Atlas stuff. And so much of it in here. So crazy. Yo, now, yeah. One of the things I remember, too, was at some point, and this is off the top of my head, folks, so I may have some of this apocryphally incorrect, but at some point, you know, some of the early what-ifs were kind of dark. They had a dark ending. And at some point, someone in Marvel came along, and it may even have been Roy, I don't know, who said, all right, look, we got to turn a corner here. Let's keep telling what-if. But they can't all end in the world ending just because, I don't know, Spider-Man missed the bus that day, you know, or whatever. Yeah. So they did have to turn the corner, and not everything was happy. You'll see an issue we're about to cover is not happy, but it's some of them, they try to make them a little brighter.
Yes, they had a lot of really catchy covers. These original issues, you know, they definitely drew the eye. And for, like you said, this was before the internet, before, you know, I mean, fandom was around, but, and I don't know, were comic shops around it? Yeah, late 70s comic shops.
70s, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, you got people talking about this stuff. I mean, I don't know, because, of course, I wasn't there when it happened, but I'm curious how this first series did in terms of getting fans talking. It lasted 47 issues. I mean, that's still a fairly good chunk of time with double-sized comics to consistently be coming out. So I'm just curious how, you know, folks then, fans in the 70s, were reacting to these.
Part of my history with the book is that people I knew loved this series. They held this series in super high regard. So before we go down that end, though, I want to mention, and you mentioned the 47 issues, so let's cover that real quick, the publication history. So Volume 1 was 1977 to 1984, 47 issues. Volume 2 is 1989 to 1998, which actually lasted 114 issues, which is amazing, ran, you know, three times as long. Then after that ends in 98, what Marvel ends up doing is a bunch of one-shots and miniseries, and they're spread across a number of years, like 2005 to 2010. They would do like five or six issues a year, and they wouldn't be numbered like 1, 2, 3. It was just like, you know, what if, I don't know, Elektra had lived, or I'm making that up, but I mean, it's whatever the stories were.
Yeah, they were done like one-shots, right?
Yep. And then they started doing miniseries, which started around 2013, and they would do this every, in fact, they just did one this past year in 2022, and they'd be 4 to 5 issues, and they'd all be loosely connected. Like, they might be all Miles Morales Dallas stories. Like, what if he became Thor? What if he became Captain America? What if he became, you know, so they would still be sort of connected, but it was a little bit more of a miniseries.
Oh, okay.
And the funny thing for me growing up is that, like, I came into fandom after Volume 1 was pretty much over. I mean, it was still going right at the end, but it was almost over. And for me, listening to my friends and everything, I felt like a zillion years passed between Volume 1 and Volume 2. It was like, what if's coming back? Oh my gosh, this legendary thing from a bygone era is coming back. I was so excited. Truthfully, it was only like 5 years between Volume 1 and Volume 2.
Well, actually, if I could jump in real quick,
yeah,
there was also a What If special.
Yes,
that
there was.
Dropped in June 1988. That has to be a script that got stuck in a drawer after the regular series was canceled. What if Iron Man had been a traitor? And I almost was going to choose this today, but it's technically not Volume 1. It's just its own thing floating, you know, what was it, about a year prior to the Volume 2 starting. So it's just a random one-shot that happened. But I just wanted to throw that out there.
Interesting. Maybe they were testing the waters.
That could have been, yeah.
Yeah. But so it's just funny, though, to me that, like, that five-year gap seemed like a lifetime as a kid. And now, sure, 5 years ago is 2018. That feels like yesterday, man. Like,
yeah.
So, you know, it's just funny, the perception of when you're a kid and time and all that.
But. Oh, yeah.
So let's get into some of these topics. And we may end up touching on some of the stuff we've already said. But let's talk about our own history collecting the sure. What If series. So, like, how did you come to the series? You know, what did you buy? You know, let me know.
So my biggest thing is I would find random issues. Quick backstory, I was always a back issue bin kid. I grew up in the late 80s, early 90s was really my thing. And, you know, at the height of the Image experiment and everything else, you know, I actually kind of got pushed because of that. Wasn't really grabbing me. I got pushed into the older stuff. So back issue bins, 50-cent bins, I loved it. You know, I was grabbing all sorts of the older Bronze Age stuff, Marvel team-ups, Marvel 2-in-1s. They were just easy to grab back then. One of those being was What If, the first volume. I'd always see kind of random issues here and there. I would grab them. But like I said, I would often say, this seems like a fun read. And either I would start reading it and then stop because I didn't want to be spoiled on how the original, you know, events took place.
Nerd.
Or I would read it and then I would feel like I'd like that over the original events because I read that first.
Okay.
But as I kept kind of getting into the older stuff, I started grabbing, you know, here and there, you know, older copies of the old Marvel Masterworks, the hardcovers, the black and white Marvel Essentials, this stuff that I was able to read, like, just pretty much the entire Silver Age of Marvel fairly cheap. And then all of a sudden I kind of, hey, what if I can comfortably read these now. I was able to get a complete run of the volume one out of back issue bins. I do have those What If classics that you talked about, which technically aren't complete because there's like a Conan issue
right
here and there that, you know, because they didn't have the rights to reprint it.
But they do include the letters page, which is pretty cool.
That's nice. But I'm still at that point, I was not finding volume two What Ifs in bargain bins at that point anymore. So that kind of is a big blind spot for me. I very much look forward to maybe Marvel will get those in trades. It seems like Marvel's team that do all the reprints and the trades, they seem to just pretty much get to everything nowadays. So
yeah, they do. Yeah,
I think it's just a matter of time before we get, you know, all of volume two in trades. I'll buy them because I definitely would love to read those.
You'd think when the TV series was going, it would have been the perfect time to do all that. And there's not a bunch of volume two on Marvel Unlimited either, which is strange. Mm. So for me, and thanks for asking, by the way, how I got involved with What If was, like, I was certainly aware of volume one. And this ties into your question earlier about how kids responded to it. Because to me, sure, with my friends, like I've told some of this before on the show, which is I would ride the school bus with some of my friends who were huge comic collectors. And they would just regale me with all these amazing tales of Marvel stories and such and such. And What If was one that frequently got brought up. Like, you know, what if Spider-Man joined the Fantastic Four? Like, the kids thought that was the coolest idea ever. And yeah, so I would hear about What If and it just sounded so amazing, right? And by the time I started collecting, which was during Secret Wars, What If was had either already ended or was about to end. I'm not really sure. So I missed the boat on that. So when Volume 2 started, I was like, I am here. I am in on the ground floor. So I made sure to buy number one. I bought pretty much every issue up until around issue 40, somewhere in there. I guess I tailed off for whatever reason. But I would still continue to read the odd issue here and there. And I worked at a comic book shop. So if it was there, I'd just pick it up, flip through it, read it, get an idea of what's going on. And, you know, over the years, I'd pick up more in the bins. I picked up the What If classic trade paperback we talked about. Yep. And I've certainly read a bunch on Marvel Unlimited. So I've got a spotty history with it, but it's kind of like the show. I just follow my passion. I'm like, oh, a Daredevil one? Sure, I'll read that. X-Men? Oh, yeah. I'm there. So a lot of it depends on the character, which is probably how the issue sold too. I'm sure there were people that didn't buy it every month. I'm sure there were people that just would pick up the ones that were relevant to them. And speaking of that, of relevant specific issues, you and I, so when we came into this, the deal we made, because you're a fan of Volume 1, I'm a fan of Volume 2, we each said, all right, we'll each pick one from each volume. And so you, like, what other ones did you not pick besides the one you're going to cover?
So it's a quick list here. I'll kind of run through it. I had, 47 issues to choose from, and it took me a little while to really pinpoint exactly what I wanted to cover. And people are probably still going to be like, why'd you pick that one? But, going through some of the ones that really caught my eye that I was really hemming and hawing about. What If issue one? What If Spider-Man joined the Fantastic Four? It's the one that started it all. I've probably read that one the most.
Mm-hmm.
It is a personal favorite of mine. It's a great story. But I felt, there's so much to offer. I didn't want to just stop at issue one. So I'm going through the whole series. What If 3? What If the Avengers had never been? This has gorgeous Gil Kane art. Everybody gets an Iron Man suit. It was really, really fun.
So
I really like that. What If number 11? What If the Fantastic Four were the original Marvel bullpen? It's written and drawn by Jack Kirby, and Kirby himself is the Thing.
Which, oh my gosh.
You read all those old Fantastic Fours and you hear about how the Thing spoke like Jack Kirby, and you always just assumed, oh, there must have been a lot of autobiographical stuff going on there with Kirby growing up on the streets, with street gangs and stuff, Yancey Street and all that. So that was a contender. What If number 23? What If Hulk's girlfriend Jarella had not died? I love the Trimpy run on Hulk, early 70s. It's a personal favorite of mine, and I really love Hulk with Jarella, and it bothers me that it seemed like that kind of romance came and went so quickly in the Bronze Age. And everybody talks about, of course, the Spider-Man, Gwen Stacy stuff. And it's like nobody talks about how Hulk had this awesome girlfriend in the Microverse. And, then they kind of did Planet Hulk way so many years later. And it was like, well, it's kind of what was going on then. I almost picked that one. A couple more. What If 24? What If Gwen Stacy had lived? Ultimately, I didn't love the ending on that. But again, fantastic artwork. You mentioned Daredevil. What If number 28? This had a couple of smaller stories in it. This had a small story called Matt Murdock, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yes.
It's drawn by Frank Miller, so it looks like the Miller run, and it is a super fun story.
It really is. It really, really is. I read that one recently.
It was just such a small story, so I felt like I couldn't go with that, but I definitely read it during the prep of this. And then What If issue 34, the humor issue? That was the one I kept going back to, and it is just, if you guys have never read that or seen that, it's filled with just these little one-panel kind of non sequiturs. I mean, dad jokes up the wazoo. There's some Fred Hembeck in there. I mean, it's a fun comic, but it was hard to pick that when there's so much, gripping drama to tell in so many of these other issues.
So I got to say something about issue 34. So first of all, it's a bit of a precursor to What The. I mean, a little bit. A little bit like that. But
God, I love What The so much.
Oh, I know. It's such a great comic. I covered an issue with Noah Tarnow a couple of years ago, and that was a blast. Now, one of the things that you may not realize, because you turn your nose up at volume 2 and you're a snob, is that issue 34 of volume 2 is also a humor issue.
Funnier?
Well, okay, I haven't read it in a long time. I'd have to dig it out and find out. But I remember thinking it was hysterical, and I loved the idea that the creative team came at it and said, okay, well, they did 34 was funny last time. We'll make 34 funny again. So I like that. Yeah. I like that parallel.
That's awesome. Hey, Shag, what about you? What favorite issues or comics did you almost pick for this?
Wow, someone finally picked up the hint and is playing the game. Thank you so much for asking, JT. That's very thoughtful of you.
I just want to be invited back someday.
So for me, I decided to stick with just volume 2. So I went through, which is a little harder because they're not on Marvel Unlimited, and that means either going into my long boxes or finding other ways to get to them. So it was a little bit more of a struggle to make my choice. But there were several that I kind of narrowed down to. I'll quickly rattle off the list of them. Number 2, which is What If Daredevil Had Killed the Kingpin, which is great. It takes place during Born Again. It's just dark, dark, darkity, dark, dark. So I decided not to go with that one. Number 4, which is What If the Alien Costume Had had possessed Spider-Man, which is a great issue. It's kind of the one that most people remember from Volume 2 because it's early in the run. Everyone is invested in the alien costume stuff, so that's a great one. One of my personal favorites is number 59, which is What If Wolverine Led Alpha Flight, which is a great issue, and I love it, but I just did Alpha Flight last episode of Once Upon a Geek, so I felt like I really shouldn't. Then number 73 is What If Kingpin Owned Daredevil? And I got to tell you, if you have any interest in Daredevil, any passing interest in Daredevil, I highly suggest you read number 73, What If Kingpin Owned Daredevil? It's a great story. Really enjoyed that. And then two that I'm going to mention, I didn't really consider, I immediately discounted these two, which was 105, which is What If Mary Jane Had Never Lost the Baby and Spider-Man Had a Spider-Girl? So that's the creation of Mayday Parker that goes on to start the MC2, which is Spider-Girl that runs for, I don't know, 500 issues or whatever. Great What If, spawned a fantastic series. That's a much larger discussion. I didn't feel like we had enough space here to really have that kind of conversation. So I immediately discounted that one. And the other one was number 114, which is What If, starring Secret Wars 25 years later, which is the idea of what if everyone stayed on the Secret Wars planet rather than made it back to Earth. And it's a fantastic story. But my buddy Sean Ross covered that on his Secret Wars and Beyond podcast. So I figured, you know what? They've done a great job there. No point in rehashing that right now. I could never probably do it as well as he did. So those are the ones I was kind of considering. All of them are great. And again, Volume 2 has a bad rap, but there's a lot of good stuff in there.
I'm surprised it gets such a bad rap. Well, why is that? Where is that coming from?
It's sort of interesting. So, like, some people view that Volume 2 is too dark. And in fact, you know, when you're getting ready for this, when I posted some stuff on social media asking people if they like Volume 1 or Volume 2, and the majority of the preference was for Volume 1, but that's because I figure, all right, we're all middle-aged comic nerds. Of course, we'd like the original, right? But the more I got answers was people were saying Volume 2 was too dark or too narrow-focused. Like you said, what if the Evolutionary War was lost rather than bigger picture like Spider-Man joining Fantastic Four? So personally, though, I think that, you know, just for me, I think those views are a little too general simply because it really varies issue by issue. I mean, every issue is a whole different world, a whole different idea. You know, if as far as that answer of the things are too dark, you know, today we're going to see a really dark issue in Volume 1.
I was going to say, if dark is your bag and you like torture and beloved heroes being murdered, you know, just hang on to your hats, kiddos.
Yep, it's coming. And then my pick in Volume 2 is much more upbeat. You know, It just varies issue by issue. So I think that's part of where the variation comes from. So I think you and I are wearing it on our sleeves here, but it sounds like your preferred is Volume 1. Is that fair to say, obviously?
Out of no other reason other than I haven't had exposure to Volume 2 as much as I would prefer.
Yeah. And mine's sort of the flip of that, which is mine's Volume 2 because I bought every issue, you know, for a number of years. I was buying it in real time. I was excited every month for it. And, you know, Volume 1, I do love it. I do. And objectively, it may be better. I don't know. I can't really judge that because I can't resist my own, like, personal inertia of a nostalgia for Volume 2. I just love it so much. So I'm biased. I recognize that. And oh, well, you know, so for me, it's Volume 2. I am interested, again, go out on the social media, folks. Let us know. Do you like Volume 1, Volume 2, or do you like those subsequent, you know, individual issues that Marvel published? So.
And if anybody from Marvel is listening, you know, get Volume 2 in trades or, like you said, fill up, you know, the digital versions so that they're accessible because I'm down to read them for sure.
Well, it usually goes hand in hand. What they usually do is they clean them up, they scan them, they get them recolored and then they publish the trade so they can make a nice clean trade, and then they've got the files, so they just throw them out there digitally at the same time or maybe give it 6 months after the trade's out there and do it. So sure. Yeah, I mean, one will follow the other, so yeah, please. Now, you know, one of the interesting things about What If is in this world of Marvel, you know, being a massive movie star stuff, we do have a What If animated series. Did you enjoy the series?
I did. I really, really liked it. I thought it was of this MCU Phase 4. I think it was in my top, you know, probably five. I thought it was really, really good. Yeah, okay. I enjoyed it a lot. It took the concept of What If, which was always this, okay, you know what really happened. Now let's show you what could have happened with an alternate history, you know, story. But they centered it on the events of the MCU, you know, the first probably 22 movies. 23 movies, and I thought they did a phenomenal job. I mean, they brought back most of the original actors for the voicing.
Right.
And they had Uatu, the Watcher. He's keeping tabs on all of this. Who was it? I think it was Jeffrey Wright is the voice of the Watcher.
I think you've got that right. Yeah.
Yeah. He does a fantastic job. And well, before I keep, did you like it? Were you a fan of that?
I did like it. Yes. And the thing was weird with me is like a lot of my family members who sort of, they don't know comics, but they like the MCU. They did not enjoy What If. And like some of them just openly dismissed it as saying, oh, that's the cartoon, right? And I'm like, cartoon? What cartoon? How can you just, again, they got, like you said, most of the original voice actors back. Yeah. You know, they told amazing stories. The animation was gorgeous.
The only way to do it was that. And not only that, but the entire season that they gave us, because they're working on a season two, it tells a story that actually is heading towards a climax. Like they had, and it had ramifications with major stakes for the entire, you know, multiverse. You know, I guess they're saying, you know, we are in this multiverse saga. I think What If is a very important part of that. Characters we saw in the What If animated series have already showed up in live action with Captain Carter.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that What if it was dismissed pretty quickly by MCU folks, I think whatever is coming down the pike, I think they're going to kind of have to revisit it, because I think there's stuff that's being introduced there that we're going to have to see later with, who knows, with the craziness, I mean, that they have coming our way. One of the things I liked, and this was a subtler thing about the show, but, you know, we have the Watcher that's doing the narrating, and then a lot of times he just is watching, you know, as his I don't know if you know that, but that's what he does. The Watcher watches.
He's never mentioned that. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. He never interferes either, ever.
Right.
But I would what I liked, they would do these moments in the show where it's like, because it's filmed like a movie. So you have these big wide shots, these establishing shots of scenery, and you would just see this ghostly image of the Watcher up in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved that, because we always get hints and stuff like that in the comics, but seeing it there, like, I look forward to a live action Watcher officially here at some point. This one, you know, Uatu himself, because...
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah. What If did a really good job with him, that character as well. They gave him a full story arc as well. It's worth a watch. I don't know. I'm surprised people, you know, didn't like it, but I liked it.
and some of it maybe too, like, I don't want to call it uneven, but I mean, some episodes were better than others, at least in my opinion. There were some episodes that felt better than others. There were some that felt more like the comic and some that felt less like the comic, but overall it was enjoyable. It was a lot of fun. I'm really glad they did it, and I can't wait to see more. And again, how crazy. I laughed a minute ago when you were describing it and you said, I don't know, like the 22nd or 23rd movie. And I'm like, how ludicrous is it that we're 23 movies into this thing?
I tell you, you know, and you run this podcast, and I mean, the Fire and Water Network is very much about finding your joy. It's amazing to me how some of these fandoms get toxic. No matter what the fandom is, it seems like there's just more anger about stuff. And it's like, do you guys realize that not only are there 23 Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, but they're a cinematic universe? Like, I could never even picture that when I was in school growing up, that, you know, an Ant-Man movie, no way. A trilogy? There's no freaking way. And then an Ant-Man trilogy that also ties into these massive other movies? Like, there's no way. And look where we are now. Like, I just take it all as it comes. I don't love all of it, and I don't hate any of it, really, because it's still an amazing time to be alive seeing this stuff in live action. I mean, it's just, who'd have thunk?
Well, you said something off the air too, which was like, you know, it's like the comics. You know, I don't buy every Marvel comic, so I like the ones I like and I just move on, you know. That's so if it. if you don't like a movie, you don't like a miniseries, a TV series, whatever, so what, just move on. There's going to be another one. And by the way, they're not just, you know, an Ant-Man movie, they're like Ant-Man movies that make, I don't know, close to $1 billion, which is insane. Yeah.
I know. Meanwhile, Ray Palmer's like, what do I have to.
Right. I can't even get on Legends of Tomorrow properly. So,
All right. Exactly.
Well, let's get moving into this. We've kept people waiting like 40 minutes now. So let's do it. So we are going to cover two issues of What If. We're going to do it kind of a high level. We're not going to dig too deep, but we are going to cover one issue from Volume 1 and one issue from Volume 2. JT, what did you bring today?
All right. So my pick was What If Volume 1, Issue 45, What If the Hulk Went Berserk?
Woohoo!
We have a cover that is primarily black, kind of a shadowy background. It is, and I always mess up his pronunciation, Bill Sienkiewicz?
Sienkiewicz.
Sienkiewicz, oh my God. So he did a few of the last of the covers for that particular volume, and he does this in his style, a kind of a haunting image of the Hulk reaching out from this shadowy background towards you. And if you look, he did like a bunch of spit coming out of the Hulk's mouth as if he was in the middle of a roar, a scream. And you have all these kind of lines coming out of his eyes and off of kind of where his brain is, including what looks like almost like a life scan, monitor. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you call it, like an EKG. And it just... If this story is about the Hulk going berserk, this cover, he's not smashing anything, but it looks like he is absolutely losing his mind.
Yeah.
It's really well done.
I don't know what fires Bill Sienkiewicz's imagination and how he visualizes this, because it's astounding. Because, yeah, and really, everything you said, I'll echo. I'll describe it a tiny bit different, which is the top of his head is almost broken into two quadrants. Like the left-hand side, at least visually for us, on the page is a fairly normal version of his head. There's some lines coming out of his eyes, like in rage, but the right hand side is like everything you just described. It's literally like his brain is exploding. The rage is exploding out of him. It is so powerful. It is so wild. His eyes are haunting. How angry he is. The spittle, like you said. I do like also there's interesting juxtaposing because I don't know whether this is a painted cover or maybe it's watercolors. I'm not sure, but it's not your typical line work. You know, this is very stylized artwork that Bill has done. And as you said, Hulk's reaching for you, and within his hand he's like crushing the word berserk, and the goofy cartoon font in contrast with a gorgeous painting. I love that contrast. It just screams comics. And it's a hell of a cover, man.
Yeah, it's good. And I know most people probably are like, well, doesn't he always go berserk? Well, this is a lot different than his typical berserk.
Absolutely.
So this issue is cover dated June 1984. It hit the shelves March 20th, 1984. Cover price was $1. Page count was 48 pages, as was kind of the usual for this particular volume. They tended to be double. Obviously, the cover was by Bill Sienkiewicz. And we have this story. Writer was Peter B. Gillis. Penciler, Ron Wilson. Inked by Ian Aiken and Brian Garvey. Letterer was Jack Morelli. Colorist, Bob Sharon. And editor was Ralph Macchio, not the Karate Kid. Okay, so in this issue, we are all the way back to the time of Hulk issue 1, way back in 1962. We should say that, of course, it kind of goes without saying, but these what ifs tended to give a little bit of, here's how it happened in your world, but here's that moment where everything changed and this is what happened instead. So we're going right to that moment where instead of Banner taking the full brunt of the gamma bomb after he throws Rick in that ditch, in this, they're both hit. He doesn't get him into the ditch. He shields Rick with his body, but then they're both hit by the gamma rays. We go to the hospital. They're both in turn, just like in the original issue. But Banner, of course, you know, turns into the Hulk and he, you know, smashes out of the room and he just runs off. We start to realize, though, that there is a telepathic link between the two. Rick and Banner, or in this case, Rick and the Hulk, they're actually probably empathic and telepathic between the two of them. They're connected. So Banner's hulking out for the first time. General Ross, of course, he's responding with his usual, with his soldiers and tanks and all that fun stuff. He learns about this connection, and classic General Ross decides to piss the Hulk off a whole lot more. In this case, so he always takes somebody that is close to the Hulk and messes with him. Well, he decides to tie Rick down and give him electric shocks.
Insane.
And he thinks this is going to somehow contain the Hulk. It fails miserably because what's also happening, unfortunately, is Rick is also dying of radiation poisoning, whereas Bruce has the Hulk that kind of absorbed it. Rick did not get any cool powers. He is very much dying. So he's dying of radiation poisoning. And in those final moments of the electroshock therapy that he's getting, all he has is this intense pain and dies. All that intense pain goes right to the Hulk, and Hulk goes berserk, as is the title of this. General Ross is out of ideas. The army is nothing. He reaches out to the Fantastic Four. Again, we're talking early Marvel Silver Age, early 60s. Fantastic Four arrive on site. The Hulk wants nothing more than to kill Ross. He's screaming it at the top of his lungs as he's smashing all sorts of, tanks and equipment. Fantastic Four arrive. It's all Silver Age fun for about two pages. And then a missile, an ICBM, is exploded by the Hulk as the Hulk and Thing fight on top of it. It reverts Thing back to Ben Grimm, and the Hulk snaps his neck, which is not a close-up shot. It's kind of from far away, and you just hear the snap, and it's shocking. Of course, the Fantastic Four is horrified by this. Johnny loses his mind. Johnny Storm, aka Human Torch, he goes flying at the Hulk. Hulk backhands him in midair, kills him, snuffs out the flame. His limp body falls on the desert floor. We cut to kind of the Nation, and Walter Cronkite is reporting on the situation. This brings Thor and Iron Man to the desert. They have the two of them kind of team up to fight the Hulk, and then Hulk gets his arms around Tony Stark. He's in his classic gold armor, his all gold armor, and basically crushes him inside of his armor. And the captions state that those life-giving circuits to Tony's damaged heart are broken themselves, and his heart stops. There's not much left that can be done. Thor makes the decision to he himself. You turn the page to the final page, the big first panel. Hulk's neck is snapped by Thor. When this happens, the Hulk reverts back to Banner. Of course, he's dead. Thor sets Banner's body on fire with lightning and says that he's going to send Banner's tortured soul to Valhalla. And then he leaves, leaving, like usual with a Hulk story, General Ross looking at all this destruction, wondering, what am I supposed to do next? Well, in this one, he looks like he's going to turn himself into the authorities and says he has a lot to atone for. The end.
Wow.
Yeah, this was a fun one.
So I don't think I'd ever read this one. If I did, I just didn't remember it. So when you suggested this one, I'm like, okay, cool. And I read it, and it just, like, it gets dark, and then it gets darker and darker and darker. Yeah. And then, dude, I mean, that I will, if I had any criticism of it, one thing is the ending is so sudden. Like, literally, Thor breaks the Hulk's neck on the last page of the comic. And yet there's still time for all the transformation and burning Banner's body and all the stuff. So, like, it almost seems like they ran out of pages. I'm not sure. But, I mean, just what a dark ending. And I'm reading this. I'm like, what goes on in JT's mind if he thought this is the one he picks? I'm terrified. I'm glad we live far apart.
I kill rats for a living, Chegg. So what I loved about this was, I mean, it truly is. I mean, every time we get to see the Hulk go full Hulk, which a lot of times, he turns into Banner, especially, so many of those classic stories from especially like the 60s and 70s, it doesn't last for more than a couple pages. This is almost the bulk of the entire story. And it's a terrible, it's not fun. It is a terribly dark story, but General Ross always comes across as a bad guy, but usually a bad guy with some redeeming qualities somehow. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But as soon as his decision to start sending electric shocks through Rick, I mean, I don't know where his mind was with that. And he does struggle with this decision, but I still don't understand why this is even a decision that he's making. So, it really could only go one way with this story. I mean, either Ross was going to die, or once Hulk has killed, I mean, I'm sure he killed soldiers along the way here. They didn't really express that. But I mean, once he kills Ben, that's one of my favorite characters of all time. It's like, okay, this might only go one way here on this.
Yeah. Yeah. Once he kills Ben, it's like, because it's one thing for Rick to die by, quote unquote, the bad guy, the antagonist doing it. I mean, it's sad. It's horrible. But it's the antagonist doing it. Once your lead murders someone like the Thing, it's like, okay, all right, this is off the rails. He's got to go down. There's no redemption here. He snapped Ben's neck. So, yeah, he's got to go.
Well, a couple quick notes I had here, because as I've already stated, I like to read the original events when I read a What If as well. So I reread Incredible Hulk issue one.
Okay.
Couple things, because we do see it here. In the very beginning, Banner's assistant was a Russian spy.
I was going to mention that. Yeah, it's not in here at all.
He is here for a panel. He's still the one that's responsible, you know, not delaying the explosion.
Mm-hmm.
But he's never mentioned again. In the original, it's Igor Starsky. We see what his deal is. He contacts, what was it, the gremlin, the little
I think that's what
Russian
it was, yeah.
Guy. You know, in the original, he's instantly kind of put in the brig. Here, we don't see him again in the comic. So I'm curious, okay, so now what? Because he created this mess, technically, and he didn't get in trouble at all. This Hulk is green instead of gray. The famous,
right.
You know, first
right.
appearance of Hulk was gray. We also get Major Talbot in here right from the get-go in the original Marvel Silver Age. He did not show up until Tales to Astonish issue 61.
So it wasn't
until he got his series back in Tales to Astonish sharing that book that we saw Talbot. So here we got him right away. Thing versus Hulk, again, usually those are a lot of fun. This one wasn't.
it was fun until the neck break.
Until the snap. Ross calls in the Fantastic Four. He did that originally in Fantastic Four issue 12 way
right.
back when. So that was kind of a cool little nod to continuity. There's a moment where Don Blake turns into Thor and flies to this crisis. And he's thinking to himself how, you know, he would really like to find a bunch of like-minded heroes and maybe start a team. I thought that was kind of a funny little thing because it wasn't Thor's idea in the originals. But I like that this Thor was thinking about that, before, you know, prior to the Avengers being formed, at least in this particular alternate history.
Well, and I think that was more for us at home to know that, that was their way of saying the Avengers haven't been formed yet. I think it's probably what that was.
Yeah, that's very possible. And then the other thing I wanted to mention at the very end. So Thor and Iron Man show up and they kind of team up against the Hulk. Thor calls down lightning and supercharges Tony Stark's Iron Man armor to then use. Where have we seen that before?
Wasn't that in the movies as well?
Yeah, that was in the first Avengers movie. Yep.
Wow, that's awesome.
I thought it was cool that, you know what, it still made it in the comics first. I mean, maybe it's happened in other ones, but I never remember seeing it until reading this What If. So I thought that was kind of neat.
Well, when I saw it, I'm like, that's a cool idea. And it's like, why didn't they do that before? And I thought, well, this must have happened at some point. And I'm just don't know my Marvel history. But yeah, it's a great idea.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, I thought it was fun.
So I want to mention there is another continuity nod in here that now, and I wouldn't have known this. It was rattling around in the back of my head, probably from Marvel Saga. And so I had to do the research on it. But there was a point in the early issues, I think it's like issue 3 or 4 of the Hulk, where Rick and the Hulk did have a mental connection because Rick got like a second dose of radiation or something like that, which then allowed Rick to mentally sort of have an empathic relationship with the Hulk. So I think that's part of what the writer's playing on here is that mental connection that was in the other Hulk issues.
Yeah, I remember that scene where it shows Rick raising a hand and then the Hulk raises his hand.
Something like that. Yeah.
They definitely, I don't know if they quite understood what to do with the Hulk in those early issues, changing of color, the way that he would change back and forth. Originally it was at night, like when the sun fell and then mm-hmm. it was, you know, so I can understand why with this, they kind of streamlined it a bit, you know, just make them green right from the beginning. Cause that's what people think and want to see. And, you know, gray is kind of a dull color here for what we wanted to see. But yeah, I'm sure that was part of it. I'm sure that he probably read all those early ones and be like, all right, what do we want to do? I'm sure the Rick connection there was part of what he wanted to play with.
Yeah, I'm sure. So a few other thoughts. So like just to put you in the time frame of this issue. So the Hulk live action TV series had been off the air for 2 years at this point when this issue was published. But the Hulk cartoon, which was only about 6 months away from being launched. So I don't know if that was already in their brain trying to think, okay, what can we do with the Hulk? I don't know if that was intentional marketing or not, but I like to think there's symmetry there. The artwork is really nice. I like what Ron Wilson does here with Aiken and Garvey as far as like the use of shadows and things like that. There's some really cool usage of shadows, especially in the first half of the book. And then there's some great coloring too. Like when the Hulk transforms and some of the coloring on the shadow, on the soldiers and stuff like that. Really nice artwork. I mean, it's not like, I'm not saying this is like some of the most impressive artwork ever, but it's just really well done. It's very enjoyable. The Hulk looks great. When they do a nice close-up of his face, they do a great job with that. I was very pleased.
There was one panel in there, and I know we're not supposed to do that, but there was was a panel where it showed after Ross makes his decision to electrify a young teenager, his face, they do a close-up of his face shrouded in shadow, but then there's Zipitone over his face as well. And for some reason, it really shows the weight of his decision. That was a really nice effect. I miss Zipitone, man. The Masters used it so good back in the day.
They really did. They really did. You know, the more we talk about Ross, I do feel like that's sort of missing from the issue is Ross and Talbot really should have got some kind of punishment. Now, they do make that final line. They have a lot to atone for. But, whether it's...
But that doesn't mean that they're going to jail, you know?
Yeah. There should have been something. Like, you know, the ICBM falls and lands on them, you know, or something accidental, so, you know, or whatever. They feel like they... Especially in a what-if. I mean, you know, anything could happen, right? Feel like they should have got some kind of comeuppance in there. But either way, I'm glad you recommended this one. I really enjoyed it. It's on Marvel Unlimited, folks, by the way. If you're a subscriber, you can go out there and read it. What if number 45? Yeah, 45. Yes. Good stuff, man. All right, so I guess it's my turn. So I picked again from volume 2. I picked What If volume number 2, number 9, which is What If the New X-Men had died on their very first mission. So this is published by Marvel Comics, cover date is January 1990, on the shelves November 21st, 1989. So cover price is $1.25, page counts 32 pages. The cover's by Rick Buckler and Sam De La Rosa. So on the cover, we've got the blue-haired Beast. He is pushing Professor X's wheelchair, and the professor is screaming in agony to the sky, and he's got a word balloon that says, "The X-Men are dead, and I killed them!" And behind them, we can see a cemetery, including a memorial marker for the fallen X-Men, with little relief faces of Cyclops, Jean Grey, Angel, Iceman, Havoc, Wolverine, Nightcrawler, Colossus, Storm, Sunfire, Banshee, and Thunderbird. And now the cover does say, "What if the X-Men died on their first mission?" It really should say, "What if the new X-Men died on their first mission?" So what do you think of the cover, man?
I like it. Anytime we see Blueford Beast, I'm usually on board. He is probably my favorite X-Men character.
Oh, okay.
It's funny because, you know, we just got off of this rollicking, fun, family-friendly story of What If number 45. And now we're going into this Xavier in anguish screaming, "The X-Men are dead and I killed them."
This certainly starts in a dark place, but it's sort of the opposite of the Hulk of the issue, which started in sort of the traditional way and then gets dark, where here it starts in a different way, very dark, but then becomes a lot more upbeat, I guess. So our writer is Roy Thomas, the man who invented What If himself, doing this issue. A penciler is Rich Buckler. Inker is Sam De La Rosa. Letter is Philip Hugh Felix. Colorist is Evelyn Stein. And editor is Craig Anderson. I'll do a quick recap of the story and then we will dive in. So in this case, in this What If, the divergence point with history actually takes place during Giant Size X-Men number 1. So in this version, the original X-Men and the all-new, all-different X-Men, or Uncanny X-Men if you prefer, both teams were killed in this version of history while trying to defeat the living island of Krakoa. Now, they succeeded, but they all died in the action. And Professor X, he's telepathically connected to them, and he actually feels the death of every single X-Men member and feels guilty for causing their deaths. And he ends up retreating into himself, and he becomes a very, very depressed shut-in. Now, the way they told the story is kind of clever because that's not actually how the story starts. All that has happened. Our story actually starts weeks after that. And it focuses on Moira MacTaggert. She is traveling from Scotland to the United States at the urging of Hank McCoy. Hank, who wasn't with the X-Men during that fatal mission, he's requested Moira help nurse Professor X back to health. Moira brings with her a very, very young Rain Sinclair, who we, as the reader, know she'll grow up to be Wolfsbane eventually. Now, once they get to America, after a very frosty reception with Xavier, Hank reveals his blue beast nature, much to JT's joy. And he reveals his beast nature to Moira and Rain, and along with the truth of the X-Men's death. Now, later in the issue there, the evil Count Nefaria, he attacks the NORAD Nuclear Missile Command Center, which did originally happen in the X-Men comics in issues 94 and 95, which was the second mission of the all-new, all-different X-Men. So here in this What If, though, Nefaria is attacked, and Professor X wants nothing to do with it, and against Professor X's wishes, Beast assembles a new ragtag team of mutants to stop Nefaria. The team consists of himself. Also on the team is Siren, who at this point is calling herself Banshee. Banshee, you know, the daughter of Banshee. Warpath, who's the brother of the original Thunderbird. Here he's calling himself Thunderbird. We've got Quicksilver. We've got Scarlet Witch. We've got Namor Rita and Rain Sinclair. So Beast programs Cerebro to mimic the powers of the deceased Nightcrawler, and thereby teleporting Beast's makeshift team all the way to NORAD. And so the mutant teams, they struggle to defeat Nefari. He's got these beast creatures called the Animen, and they struggle to defeat him. But young Rain's powers are activated remotely by Professor X. So she, in her Wolfsbane form, she creates a much-needed distraction so our heroes can prevail. They defeat the Animen, and they stop Nefarious threat. Now, throughout the adventure, you know, these mutant heroes, it's Roy Thomas at his best, right? Because he's got them bickering, he's got them flirting, he's got them helping each other, and ultimately they bond, and you believe it. And now, with Xavier's, you know, renewed sense of purpose, these mutants agree to carry on the dream and become the new X-Men. With the exception of Quicksilver and Scarlet Witch, because of previous engagements, they say they'll be on as reserve status. So under the guidance of Professor X, the heroes of Beast, the new Thunderbird, the new Banshee, Namor Rita, and Wolfsbane, they are the new X-Men. So I got to ask you, buddy, what did you think of this?
I enjoyed the crap out of it.
Yay!
It is typical late 80s Roy Thomas, where it is wordy, wordy, wordy.
You say that, but like that's a bad thing.
No, I'm okay with that. I like all that stuff. True to form, I reread Giant Size X-Men number 1 and X-Men 94 and 95. I read this What If, I read those, and then I read this What If again, because, again,
nerd,
you get a lot more out of this story. There's some really subtle ways that Roy Thomas changed events. I'm curious if you had noticed them. Why don't you go first? This was your pick, so I'm curious why you picked this one and what you loved about this.
Well, sure, and we'll bounce back and forth here. So for me, I wanted to pick an X-Men issue specifically because that's my biggest Marvel fandom of, especially back then. I mean, truthfully, Daredevil's probably my favorite character, but of my fandom, I went nuts for X-Men. I was buying all those books, so this really sings to me, this particular story. And just to put you guys in perspective here, so at this point, when this issue of What If was on the shelves, so the X-Men were still in the Chris Claremont era, the ones on the shelves at that point. So Mark Silvestri had just finished his run. Jim Lee had just come out of the book within the last month or two, and they're still in the Australian outback. So that's what's going on here. So this was a chance for a writer other than Claremont to dip back into X-Men history and get to play with all the toys.
I wonder if Claremont did any What Ifs. Because he was so protective of the X-Men stuff.
Yes, he did. If memory serves, I want to say he did do like a, I'm probably going to get the name wrong here, guys, but like What If Jean Grey Had Lived kind of What If, I want to say.
Okay.
I can't promise that. That's off the top of my head. I'm sure somebody's already writing the comments. No, shag it with issue, blah, blah, blah. Okay, sure. Thank you. I appreciate that. this is what the struggle with podcasting is when you're talking on the fly. So one of the things I liked about this is, and you noticed this, and I know you're about to talk about it, and that's why I want to say this first, is Roy Thomas, he follows the X-Men continuity, especially for Giant Size X-Men number 1 and X-Men 94 and 95. But he does it without bogging down the reader too much. Now, I kept referencing X-Men history. That's not in the comic. I was referencing it in my recap. He told this thing really smooth. He did not lapse into a whole lot of like, this is what happened in the real Marvel Universe. Instead, it just read like a story. It was entertaining. The issue actually begins after the Divergence has even happened. You know, it follows Moira. So, you know, it's very smooth. You get a couple pages of X-Men history, not, you know, parallel, you know, not the original history, but what happens in this world. So we learn how the X-Men, the new X-Men were formed and how they died and all that. Now, by contrast, there was another What If, and I'll talk about that for just a second. It was issue 23 of volume 2, which is What If the all new, all different X-Men had never existed, which was basically the X-Men, the new X-Men never got formed. The original X-Men beat Krakoa and they kept going. So all the X-Men adventures were had by the original X-Men. Kurt Busiek wrote that one. And while it's very entertaining, like that's an example of how a story did get bogged down in continuity. Like that one is fun to read for me as an X-Men nerd, but I could imagine someone else found it pretty impenetrable because it kept, you know, there was so much X-Men history. Here, I just felt like it was smooth. So tell me, having read, you know, the original Giant Size and then 94, 95, and then this, what's your thoughts on this? And what were some of the stuff you noticed?
So I agree with you wholeheartedly. I like that. you don't need to read those at all to enjoy this. You get a little bit more out of it if you kind of have a working knowledge of the regular stuff. But yeah, Roy doesn't make that known. You know, same thing with seeing Quicksilver in here. You know, Quicksilver is, at this point, he's married to Crystal of the Inhumans.
Yep.
Scarlet Witch and Vision are very much, they should be married as well.
They're on their honeymoon in this.
They're on their honeymoon.
Yep.
So it was cool seeing two of those old school mutant characters in here. But yeah, very much looking at kind of continuity. Now, what I like was there was a couple of really fun little subtle things that I didn't know until I reread the original ones. And two of those two things are in this one, you know, Beast is trying to tell the Avengers. He's trying to get a hold of the Avengers. Hey, you know, Count Nefaria is taking over NORAD, but he's getting Jarvis, and Jarvis is saying, oh, I'm sorry that, you know, they're predisposed. In the original, it was Beast at the time he was a member of the Avengers getting a hold of the X-Men saying, you know, hey, this is going on at NORAD. Count Nefaria, we can't take care of it. We're busy.
Oh, wow. That's a nice I completely, now you say it, I remember that, but what a great touch. That's a great touch.
Yeah. I thought that was cool because, you know, it's technically kind of happening along the same bit of timeline. And it's just funny that the Beast is still the one that's trying to figure this out. The other thing, and this is at the end of this story and at the end of X-Men 95.
I know where you're going with this one. I totally caught this one.
Okay. Where Banshee tries to save Thunderbird in the original.
Yep.
And then in this one, it's Thunderbird that saves Banshee. Of course, they're different characters, but still, I like that flip of the characters doing that.
Yeah, because Count Nefaria is escaping in his airplane, and that's what causes Thunderbird to die. Exactly right. And in this one, Thunderbird saves Banshee. So yeah, it's a really nice symmetry. I saw that and really, and I think they don't quite hang a lantern on it, but Roy does say in the issue here, like, I won't let her die like my brother died. You know, it's enough to remind the reader, like, oh, yeah. So, I like that. I like that usage very much so.
A couple things that I just also liked about this issue, aside from it having a lot of, Bluford Beast stuff going on, and he kind of is like the field leader, because again, Xavier is kind of just, like you said, he kind of reverted into himself the anguish that he got from all of those X-Men dying. He wasn't really much help at all. So Beast was kind of doing all of it. I like that early in this, we see that Beast has such a strong loyalty to Xavier. In the wake of this Krakoa incident, he quits the Avengers and is living with Xavier at the mansion because someone's got to take care of him. I thought that was a really nice little touch, because for a while there throughout, you know, the Bronze Age into the 80s, you know, Beast was, well, he was an Avenger, then he was a Defender, and then he was on X-Factor. I mean, he didn't have a ton to do with Xavier for a long time.
You know what you just made me think of? Wasn't that also a plot point in one of the X-Men movies where Beast was... Where Zate was taking care of Xavier?
Yeah, that was in that Days of Future Past movie they did when they do the flashbacks to the 70s. Yeah, we see Hank is taking care of
a distraught Professor X.
Yes, very very drunk Professor Xavier.
I want to mention one other reference that you may or may not caught. There's twofold. When Beast is wearing this rubber mask when Moira and Rain first get there, and that is a nod to the Amazing Adventure issues when Beast first transforms into the blue furry thing. He wears a rubber mask to try and hide. I just read all these issues recently, so that's why it's fresh in my mind. He wears this, there's actually two issues where he develops this rubber mask. They spend way too much time on it. But anyway, he wears this rubber mask to fool people. And then in here, when he pulls it off, it's in the writing, but not the artwork. They say, hey, he's all gray and furry. So, because in original, in those Amazing Adventures, he was actually gray, not blue. And so, but here, I think Roy intended for Beast to be gray in these issues to sort of carry that thread over. But the color is colored in blue, which is fine because it's more recognizable that way. But I think that was another continuity thing Roy was purposely trying to do, is trying to make the Beast gray and the rubber masks that he used at this time period.
Yeah, I had that in my notes, but you got real excited. I wanted you to have your
That's where you go, nerd. You call me that. Yep.
A couple other things I liked. Well, actually, I didn't like. I always find this very unsettling in the comics. Whenever they show Vision in anything other than his green, you know, costume and yellow cape, like the fact that he's all red skin, because we see him here in just his, you know, Speedo.
Right.
And it's just always weird. So I'm like, wait a minute, who's that? Oh, it's Vision. I forget that, you know, he's all red. That always, I always get weirded out by that.
Why do robots wear clothes? It's so weird.
Yeah. should just be part of them, but it's not. What I really liked about this was Namorita, because I always had a crush on Namorita during the New Warriors days.
Yep.
And it was great seeing her here and seeing her kind of put to a good use with, because she's got, you know, super strength that can fly. And it also kind of got me thinking, we don't really have an aquatic themed X-Man, really. So then I kind of was thinking, man, if they did a sequel to this with this particular lineup at the end of this, I wonder if we would have seen water-based adventures. You know, I know a lot of the rest of the All New, All Different in the 70s, I mean, a lot of space stuff, but I'm curious if the stories would have gone a different way.
Well, she makes a comment about that. She says something like that, you know, if we can get near water, I can show you what I can really do. I'm glad you mentioned her, because it's really interesting. Roy was ahead of the game here. He tapped into something probably unknowingly, or people tapped into this story later, which I doubt, but like using Namorita, right? She first appeared in 1972. And really, for the most part, she appeared in various comics, but as far as being featured primarily, it was pretty much Submariner comics. So here, this is still a year before the New Warriors comic came out. So she was not an unknown, but she was still a very background minor character. So the fact that Roy chose to use her here, he took time to develop this teenage girl persona for her. I mean, she's snarky. She makes references to MTV and Star Trek. I mean, again, ahead of the game. Same thing with Banshee, or I still call her Siren, but, you know, because she first appeared in 1981. Same sort of thing. She really was only a major player in the Fallen Angels miniseries. So here in the What If storyline, this takes place 2 years before X-Force was ever published, which is really where she kind of started appearing more and more and more and more. And here Roy put her in there. He developed a conflict between her and Warpath, or Thunderbird, whatever you want to call him, and included some flirting. And sure enough, during X-Force, Siren and Warpath apparently developed a romantic relationship.
Oh, I was going to ask you about John Proudstar's brother. You know, that is the Warpath from X-Force.
Yes, it is. Yeah, because
the late New Mutants into X-Force. Okay.
Exactly, because he first appeared in 1984. So again, Roy was very careful to only use existing characters, but he picked such minor characters that no one was thinking about, and yet they all became major players later. So he first appears in 1984. He's really only featured in New Mutants as part of the Hellions team before now. So here, again, picks him out of the blue, shows up here a couple years later in X-Force. He becomes a huge deal. So again, Roy really tapped into something here, some zeitgeist ahead of everyone else as far as what characters really should be breakout characters in the future.
You know, and I think that kind of goes with how Roy's career sort of was. He never really seemed to have slowed down. I mean, he was writing, because I know he had a whole stint on Avengers West Coast after John Byrne's run. And I mean, he still kept going and still had stuff. I think that just kind of tells you, you know, he had a good mind to write what he was writing. I mean, all the stuff he did at DC, and then all the stuff he did at Marvel, even in this era where he comes back to Marvel, you know, in the late 80s into the 90s, he was, I don't know, I think he was always kind of firing on all cylinders. He knew how to tell a story.
This is a lot of fun. So I want to mention the artwork, because it's fine. It's probably the best way to say it. It's like it's absolutely solid. It's nicely illustrated. The coloring's great. The line work's great. The storytelling's really well done. It's well rendered. It's perfectly enjoyable. It's just not mind blowing. It's not innovative. You're not going to read this and be like, wow, they did this really amazing stuff. But you know what? It does the job it's intended to do. It tells you the story. Yeah. You get it, and the art's enjoyable. So I think the art is a plus. It's not a wowzers. And in 1989, that's what they were looking for from Marvel. Yeah. But yeah. I enjoy it.
I definitely enjoy the artwork. It's you know, I think the story is more powerful than the art in this particular issue.
That's fair.
But at the same point, a lot of these what ifs, especially ones like this that do have a lot of continuity to play with, and certainly a lot of characters. If you're going to care at all about where this story starts and then where it ends, we have to care about those characters, and you can't draw that. You really got to write it. But this is still, there are, you know, with how tightly packed this story is and how much is in here, there are still some great scenes, some great shots. And I don't know, maybe it's because I did reread issues 94 and 95. I still have some of that Dave Cockrum stuff floating around in my brain. So
sure.
Maybe that even it helps me enjoy this, because I already know the NORAD battle with the Animen and all that fun stuff. So I don't know, maybe that's what's going on, but I really liked it. I love the group shot at the end, even though Rain does look like a little person instead of a kid.
Yeah.
Which I did want to ask you about that. So I know you are a admitted New Mutants fan.
Yeah.
I've read a chunk of that stuff, but I haven't read all of it. I do intend to at some point. But how do you feel about Rain in this story? Do you feel that it fits? Does it make sense with her character being with Moira?
Actually, I like that. I thought that was a really clever pairing. In fact, one of the things I'm going to say something and then come back to your question. One of the things that Roy did really well was give everybody a personality. You know, sometimes these stories, it's a character and a power, and that's what they are. Here, each character had their own unique personality, and I felt like I got to know each character, which amazing that he had time to do that in a 30-page comic or whatever it is. And in Rain's case, I thought the pairing of Rain and Moira was a really good idea. Using Rain at such an incredibly young age is risky, because Rain's also not a lot of people's favorite New Mutant character, but her and Moira have a logical connection because of the geography. And you know what? X-Men always had, once Kitty Pryde came along, ever since Kitty Pryde's been, there's always been a teenage character around, whether it's her or Jubilee or somebody else. There's always been a much younger character. In this case, I'd say Rain's probably like 9, so it's probably child endangerment kind of era. But, you know,
for that was the 80s, Shag. That did, you know, she's the latchkey kid of the X-Men. It's okay.
That's true, I guess. So I was perfectly fine with it. In fact, that last panel is so exciting to me, with the team running out at you in costume. Like, the whole From the Ashes kind of concept here, where you see this new and unexpected team form. Like, I want to read the further adventures of this X-Men team. Yeah. I want to know what happens next. I'm so excited by this.
I agree. And that's kind of what I was getting at with before. You know, some of these what ifs, they deserve to be more than one and done. Like, sure. I do want to see what happens with this. Because, again, you kind of care about all these. One of the characters we didn't really talk about was the new Thunderbird here. You know, he agreed to join on this mission, but I think his idea was to probably kill Xavier.
Yeah.
For you know, blaming him for killing his brother. And he has a turnaround as well. So again, tightly packed story, but it's all there. If you're, yeah, I like comics when it would take you a good half hour to read them. You know, I like kind of just, you know, sitting back and kind of enjoying whatever the world is that they're showing us. You know, it's definitely lots to read, but it's all relevant. It's all necessary, I think.
Yeah. And the fact that he could take the characters and weave them together into a team that you want to see do more and interact and develop the bonds and the flirting and the conflict. It's just, yeah. And Roy's an expert, so I shouldn't be that surprised, but I just love it.
Sure. Now, let me ask you this, because I have two. Was there anything here that you particularly did not like, especially with your X-Men fandom? Is there anything that seems wonky to you at all, or do you love this cover to cover?
I mean, knowing what happens in X-Men 94 and 95, they really did shortcut that story. But you know what? For the purposes of this, that's fine. You know, for what they needed to tell, I'm fine with that. They really did have to shortcut a lot of that. One thing that I could complain about as an X-Men fan, but I actually like, was that Hank reprogrammed Cerebro to duplicate Nightcrawler's powers. So now Cerebro can teleport people, which is like, from an X-Men perspective, you want to be like, that doesn't work that way. But you know what? It's kind of a cool extrapolation that could have worked for this team. You know, what if this was a team of X-Men that got to teleport places? That would have been a neat idea. So
yeah, they wouldn't have any use to have an X-Jet or anything like that.
Exactly.
I didn't understand that part. I read it twice. I was like, what? Because I felt like there was no precedent set for that. And all of a sudden it's like, how do you do that? That didn't make any sense to me other than for plot. But
right, sure.
Again, it's comics and it you know, it's such a minor thing. The one thing that actually did kind of stick in my craw, if I can say that on the air, is the very last panel, the Watcher making a joke.
Oh,
about
okay.
Various mutant related comic book spinoffs.
Oh,
that felt so out of place after this kind of fairly serious story all the way through. Because at the very end, you know, he's narrating as this new team is running at you, and he goes, I'll just read it. It goes, often the seeds of victory in one universe read defeat in another. And so my ancient eyes are accustomed to witnessing at least as many tragedies as triumphs. But not this time. For no matter which or where the world, it seems there will always be X-Men and X-Factor and New Mutants and Excalibur. And it's trailing off. And he's reading off all this stuff. And it's like... I'm wondering if that was just Roy making a commentary that, hey, maybe there's too many mutant-related books. I don't know. But it seemed odd that Uatu was telling us this joke. I don't know.
Oh, I found it funny. It was a funny joke. Everyone says there was so many X-Men books to follow. And, you know, if you want to play the super serious card, then you got to say, all right, you know what? Uatu, one of the worlds he monitors is ours, where they publish the comic books. So then you could no prize. it that way. So now I just, it was a funny joke and I was perfectly fine with it. I thought it was cute.
All right, fair enough. I'm all out of no prizes, so I can't mail you one.
Fair enough. All right, folks, so this both issues are available on Marvel Unlimited. Go out and read them. They are both great reads. They're both very different emotional roller coasters, so just brace yourself for that. But I think they're both awesome. Now, JT, thank you so much for appearing on the show and sharing your love of What If. This has been an absolute blast, and now I won't ever have to wonder, what if I didn't invite JT to this episode? So why don't you tell the listeners where they can find more of you?
So I don't run my own podcast. I'm a professional podcast hangers-on, but I am on the Epic Marvel podcast, which is run by Curtis Findlay, and we talk about those Marvel Epic collections that we were talking about earlier. He always has a co-host, similar to, you know, a lot of those good discussion-type podcast shows. Not so much this one. That
you can see the quality of guests I get, so you understand.
Oh, wait, I was supposed to, I do want to be invited back. So yeah, this one is included. I'm on the West Coast Avengers episodes. We're going right through basically covering, you know, 15 to 20 issues in an episode and kind of go through those. I talk about those. And then I'm also on his Tomb of Dracula series of podcasts. Those are in Complete Collections, which are a different trade paperback. They're basically Epic Collections without that trade dress. But we've been going through those every Halloween. We post a couple episodes of that. So, you know, he keeps me busy over there, and that's about all for right now, but I got a couple of irons in the fire I'm working on.
Well, thank you so much, JT, for appearing on the episode. This has been an absolute blast. I love talking about What If. I enjoyed talking with you. It's been so much fun, so thank you very, very much. Now, folks, come back next time when we're going to cover another topic that brings us joy. What will that topic be? Sorry, folks, you're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm JT.
And remember, life is short. Focus on the positive. Find your joy.